Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, author Jabari Asim discusses his novel Yonder with journalist Evan F. Moore. The following conversation originally took place May 15th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Festival.
Jabari Asim's latest novel, Yonder, centers the experiences of a group of enslaved people living on a plantation in 1852. It tells tales of their daily lives, their attempt to escape, their resistance, and their humanity in the face of unspeakable cruelty. He's a writer and multidisciplinary artist who directs the MFA program in creative writing at Emerson College, where he's also the Elma Lewis Distinguished Fellow in Social Justice. His nonfiction books include The N-Word, Who Can Say It, Who Shouldn't, and Why, What Obama Means for Our Culture, Our Politics, and Our Future, Not Guilty, 12 Black Men Speak Out on Law, Justice, and Life, and We Can't Breathe, on Black Lives, White Lies, and the Art of Survival. His books for children include Whose Toes Are Those? And Preaching to the Chickens, the story of young John Lewis. His works of fiction include A Taste of Honey and Only the Strong. He's here to discuss Yonder with journalist and author Evan F. Moore, co-author of the book Game Misconduct, Hockey's Toxic Culture and How to Fix It, and an adjunct journalism professor at DePaul University. Welcome to you both.
Yeah, so I guess I don't know if I was introduced or whatever, but I'll say it again. Evan Moore, author, writer, and here we have Jabari Asim, who wrote the pretty dope book Yonder, and I guess we'll get right to it. You ready?
Yep, all set.
All right, let's go with something, you know, simple. What led you to write Yonder? What was the thought process and why you wanted to do it and everything else?
Well, if you're not familiar with it, it's a novel that takes place in an unnamed southern community in 1852. And much of the action revolves around enslaved African Americans attempting to maintain familial and romantic bonds under the most difficult circumstances. And I guess in terms of particularly my fiction, Evan, it usually revolves around some kind of romance or some kind of attempt to have romance, because I'm a sucker for romance. I like those kinds of stories. I like to think of myself as a romantic person. And so I was struck by the real life story of William Lee, who had been enslaved by George Washington and had served him during the Revolutionary War. And George Washington had promised him, he said, you know, you've served me so well, when this is over, the woman you love, her name was Margaret Thomas, she was a free woman, she was not enslaved. So George Washington said, you know, she can actually come and live in Mount Vernon with you when this is over. And when it was over, George Washington changed his mind. So William Lee's soulmate never got to live with him, despite the fact that she was not enslaved. And I was always intrigued by the story. I thought, imagine being in circumstances where you're serving essentially in combat, right? This is violent conflict. But one of the things that motivates you and keeps you going is that you get to be with the person you love at the end of it. Oh, no. And then you're told, guess what? You will not. Right, so that was the kind of story that was circulating in the back of my mind before I began to write this story. And my story is fiction, but I kept the names of William and Margaret. That's actually one of the couples in Yonder. And I was walking down the street in Champaign, Illinois, some years ago, and the first lines of the book came to me: "All of us have two tongues." And got out my little notebook I had in my back pocket, and I wrote it down, and I said, I will return to this later. I'm sure there will be more context for these words that have come to me. And eventually that happened, and it became Yonder. So the book kind of emerged from those circumstances.
Gotcha. And yeah, from reading the book, I obviously noticed that there's a first handful of chapter, there's a point of view of the characters' names, and then also from the white folks in the book, and not from their point of view, but they're clearly mentioned. And you tell me a little bit about why you decided to, you know, to kind of look at it that way.
Sure. So as you've noted, there are multiple narrators in the novel. As the action moves along, different people tell the story. And that originally the story was entirely William's. William is one of the characters. And initially, when I began to write the story, he was telling the story. But these other characters began to welcome themselves into the discussion. And I've been doing enough books by now to know to listen to those characters when they begin to speak and say, look, I have something to say here, right? So so that became part of my narrative strategy. At the same time, there are chapters in the novel that have no narrator. And those chapters tend to do with the action of the enslavers as opposed to the enslaved. And I wanted to write a story, sort of a subversive story, in which the enslavers do not get to tell the story. They do not get to seize control of the narrative and say, this is actually what happened, right? So that's the reason why I took that particular approach.
Gotcha. Then speaking of that, I felt like we were writing it, like in how you labeled the different like groups and the hierarchy and the politics of the plantation and everything else. You called the enslavers thieves. And you explained a little bit about why you decided to label those folks as thieves, because it's true, it's facts.
Because the book is told strictly from the point of view of the enslaved, and they consider themselves stolen, right? They're stolen people laboring on stolen land. And those circumstances are never unavoidable to them because of the power imbalance in the community in which they are living. And in order to be stolen, you have to have, you have to have thieves. You can't have theft without thieves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was important to look at the ways in which the two tongues of the enslaved people operate. They have a tongue, they have a lingo, a language that they use among themselves, and they have a different one when dealing with their oppressors.
Gotcha. And kind of bringing this conversation around to what we've been seeing in the world last few days about, and not a few days, but in recent years, because, in the summer reckoning, a lot of folks were like, we need to, black folks, particularly black creatives like Jabari, that need to, run point on our stories, right? And also, I guess what I'm really, trying to say is, when we hear about the 1619 Project and all the pushback from that, and pretty much any pushback from anyone black who writes about anything, right? I mean, let's be honest, and I guess, what I'm trying to say is, you think the book is kind of, right on time in terms of what we're dealing with in the world and what folks are trying to push back on black creatives like yourself and telling those stories and being completely honest about stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a good question. Thank you for it. In my nonfiction books, I often write about something that I call narrative combat, which is the clash of stories. Who gets to tell the story? Who gets to say what happened? And so in fiction, I'm trying to manifest that same conflict by putting language in the mouths of fictional characters that I've created. But yeah, it's essentially an age-old conflict that you have identified, that almost since we've been on this continent, since our ancestors have been on this continent, there has been a conflict in terms of who gets to tell the story, not just of the continent, but our particular story, right? The story of our journey through enslavement and ongoing oppression and delusional white supremacy and violence against our communities and violence within our communities. But how that goes down, how that information is relayed, needs to come from us, is what I argue. And that's part of the motivation for writing the book.
Right, because in the book you're telling, it's at the heart, a love story. And I feel like when you saw content in the past, whether it was movies, TV, or anything else about what went down on plantations, it was just like, obviously, about the violence and the systemic things and everything else, but why was it, kind of important for you to, with all this other stuff going on in this time in history and how violent and effed up it was, to tell the heart of it, two people wanted to be together?
Yeah, a couple things. One was that Thomas Jefferson wrote this book called Notes on the State of Virginia. And in that book, he argued that black people were incapable of genuine romantic attachment, that we were motivated solely by animal urges and sexual appetite. And for about 100 years, that book was the most influential book in terms of white intellectual thought about the capabilities of black people. And what it did was it provided a rationale for breaking up our families during the period of enslavement. The rationale was, we can break up their families because their concept of family, their concept of affection, of attachment, of romance is different from ours, right? He said their pains are quickly forgotten. They're briefly felt and soon forgotten, right? So that was the rationale. And we know that isn't true, right? So when we're writing, we can take every opportunity to say, not only was this harmful, but it's ridiculous, right? And so the other aspect of that is my sister's a historian, and years ago she was doing some work on Reconstruction. And I said, well, you know, tell me some interesting story about your research. And she said, well, one of the most fascinating things about Reconstruction was the efforts that black people made to reunite their families once they were emancipated. Because families have been broken up, right? Cousins, uncles, lovers, mates, spread all over the country. And that also fueled the growth of the African American press. Because a lot of those early newspapers were simply broadsheets saying things like, looking for my husband, answers by the name of Evan, stands about 6 feet tall. It was just lists like this, right? And that also motivated literacy. Black people had to teach themselves to read and write so that they could create these ads, right? And she said these stories were so heroic. So that was always in the back of my mind too, right? What are the efforts that black people made to keep their families together despite circumstances in which not only was it illegal for them to have families, but the efforts to have families were violently repressed, right? So again, those are some of the, you know, the ideas kind of swirling at the center of the book.
Right, right. And when you, I mean, because obviously from my end, pitching my book was kind of controversial in some circles, and then yours and these days and everything else, you've written quite a few books. And was there any point where you wanted to get a point across and maybe from a publisher that you received some sort of pushback?
Sometimes. I think I could say that probably earlier in my career, I got more of that. I'm fortunate now to sort of be at a space in my career where I have some degree of credibility and don't have to sell my point of view as much. But yeah, so, you know, one of the things, particularly in fiction, you know, you have these ideas, but at the same time, fiction, it has to entertain. It has to be a story that compels the reader to turn the page and find out what's happening. So that's more of the conflict, right? It's like, okay, I have ideas. I know I have these ideas, right? But at the same time, people don't buy the book. They don't engage with the book. And those ideas go nowhere, right? So the challenge is to create compelling characters and compelling stories that will keep people turning those pages.
Got it. And I guess it kind of goes back to an earlier question about how we tell stories about slavery and other things. Like, are there any things that you've seen over time, where it's movies, TV show, or books that you're like, well, they did that right? Or is it any of you was like, what the hell are they doing?
Well, I will be... I will focus on the things that I think have been done well. And I think in recent years, probably in the last 15 or 20 years, we've seen a lot of really powerful fiction, as well as nonfiction, that deal with this period and have had different approaches to it. You know, the Ta-Nehisi Coates' The Water Dancer, Colson Whitehead's Underground Railroad, Robert Jones's The Prophets. It's a lot of good work out there. And most of that work is coming from different points of view and different angles. And what that illustrates to me is there are so many stories that have yet to be told, and there's no one way to tell any of those stories. So I think we've actually barely scratched the surface of the stories that will emerge from artists engaging with this period. Because really, the way I see it is it's an epic struggle. You know, we read about the Odyssey, we read about the Iliad, we read about the Greatest Generation, you know, and if you think about the struggle of African Americans to survive and thrive on this continent under these circumstances, it's nothing less than epic, right? And so we want to make sure that we convey that quality of the experience, that aspect of the experience in our writing.
Right, because if some of you follow me on Twitter or now, whatever, I like to ask questions like straight up, because I remember one time I asked non-black followers, what did they learn about black history? What did they learn about the civil rights movement? And basically when they first engaged with black history. And it was some of it was shocking, some of it wasn't really. It was a myriad of some people didn't get black history until maybe their black friends told them, or maybe in college or something like slavery, like racism was a Southern problem, or one line in the Martin Luther King speech. I mean, yes, I say all I have to say is like, what parts of Black history do you feel like the masses are just completely unaware of? I mean, that's, I know that might be like a loaded question, but I guess if you want to narrow it down to a couple of things, you'd be like people should know about this specific thing or.
Well, one of them obviously is this period of enslavement. There was a blowhard on Fox News, was really popular a few years ago, who had this big tirade in which he said the slaves were well fed, and that was it was remarkable to me, just looking at comments, monitoring commentary, how many people sort of embraced that idea, right? Which is not a new idea; it's an old idea, but it's one that we're always pushing back against. But I would say all of it. You know, there's no aspect of the history that can be compartmentalized away from the rest of it. And I would also say even those of us who study it with some degree of intensity must readily acknowledge that there's so much of it that we don't know either, right? So we're constantly learning and constantly educating each other because it's a very large sphere, right? We've just begun, despite all of these efforts, all of these remarkable and admirable efforts to really just scratch the surface of it.
Gotcha. And since you've written so many books, like, you know, even like when authors come down to their pub date, they all have these different like things they do. Like some, I mean, when I wrote my book, I popped up at a local bookstore and just like signed it, or, you know, we'll buy a copy and then pass on to someone who we think could get something out of it. So if you've written a lot of books over time, and some people, they just go to sleep that day, and some people have a celebratory adult beverage. I mean, what's your pub date, thing?
Well, you know from your social media activity, that one of the things that the writers do is they have unboxing day now. So you get your box, a book from the publisher, you do a video, or a photograph of you taking the book out of the box. I've done that sometime. It's a real challenge, and writers talk about this a lot, and it's hard to talk about it without sounding obnoxious, right? Because you want people to know about your book. You really do. You're excited about this. You've been mm-hmm. working on this. At the mm-hmm. same time, I fear that people are scrolling through and they go, oh, there he goes again.
Back on that bullshit.
Talking about that. We've heard enough about that book. Let it go. You know, but you can't let it go because you've been working on it for years. And you know if no one buys it, you won't have the opportunity to work on another one. Right? So it's a conundrum.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, because I remember like from my book, like I think I did social posts from signing the book contract, yeah. The name, the cover,
right.
The pre-order, when it's pre-ordering on live, to the video, to pub date. And because when you get to be in this space, like, you just never know if this is going to come again. So you just kind of like take it all in. And, you know, thinking of that, and obviously the bunch of authors here at this Fester conference, but there's also people who are interested in writing books and probably out here looking for some type of guidance. And as we all know, you know, writing books, they aren't for the timid. I mean, it's a lot. It takes up a lot of time and space, and you may doubt yourself at some point, but when you have that book in your hand and you realize that you did it, and I guess what I'm asking you, you know, is for anyone who's out here who's interested in writing a book or even getting involved in that space, like, you know, what would you tell them?
Read obsessively, I would say, first of all, and develop a thick skin, because that's required, and to approach it with a degree of humility, right? So I always acknowledge when I start something that I'm entering a conversation that has already begun, right? I might bring my two cents, but it's not a brand new thing, right? Especially where African American literature and history is concerned. I had a couple of pivotal moments. You and I had an opportunity to talk about our journeys as writers before we got up here. One of the people we had in common was Gwendolyn Brooks, who was pivotal in both our careers. Mm-hmm. I had no intention of being a writer, and I was in college, and she did a three-day residency, they called it, sponsored by the Women's Studies Residential College at my college. And I went to the first thing. I don't know why. I don't know what I went and did that for. Why did I go and do that? Because it changed my life, right? So I was so mesmerized and so transformed, I had an epiphany, right? And I actually cut all my classes for the next 3 days. I didn't go to any of my assigned classes. I got her schedule, and wherever she was, she'd look up, and I was sitting in the front row. And she was there for the Women's Studies Residential College, of which I was not a part, right? And then the last day she was there, they had some fancy reception for her. And it was, I guess part of it was I had this attitude, right? I was like, we have this prominent African-American writer, but they don't seem to really be inviting the African-American community to, you know, to bask in her genius, as it were. And so I went with a classmate to one of those events, and I remember they had brie and cheese. I mean, brie and wine. Wine and brie. We talked about this. I had never encountered brie before. I'm from North St. Louis. And I was like, don't even know what that is, right? I'm going to pass. And But I had a bunch of my poems, right? And my classmate, she said, give them to her. Give them to her. So I gave them to Gwendolyn Brooks. I mumbled some stuff, and then I left, right? And then a week later, I got a note from Gwendolyn Brooks saying, young man, thank you for sharing your work. You know, you need to keep doing this. Well, so I changed my major and everything. I just went nuts, right? I said, I'm fully committed. I'm going to do this thing, right? But the humility came from I had a professor named Leon Forrest, and I would banter. He was very kind and patient. He's one of the few African-American professors. And I used to kind of swagger, right? And I would say to him, yeah, Professor Forrest, I'm going to show you my work, man, because you know, I'm a poet, man. And you know, you're going to be humbled, dude. You know, and he was always really nice about it, right? And so one day I'm in his office, and I give him some poems, and I kind of like slap him down, you know? And he looks at him, he takes a really long time, right? And he's just like, he's not saying anything, he's not giving me a pat on the back, you know, he's just not doing anything for my ego, right? And finally he says, you know what, go over to my bookcase. So I go over to his bookcase, and he has me pull this collection of poems by Richard Wright and turn to these haiku. And he had me read this particular haiku in which a snowflake lands on a boy's palm. It's three lines. And I'm reading it, and I realize in those three lines there's more profundity, history, emotional resonance, eloquence, in three lines than in everything I had done up to that point, right? And so I just kind of like shrunk, right? I got about 4 inches shorter when I was standing there. And I handed him the book like this, and he said, do you see, son? Do you see? And I said, yes, sir. And I slunk out of there, right? And so that was the lesson for me. You know, yeah, I call myself a writer. What have I read that I think that what I'm doing is something special, right? When in fact, it is not, right? So I was very grateful to him for, you know, kind of gently saying, you know, young man, let me pull your coat and tell you some things you need to look at, some things you need to do before you go strutting around here telling people you're a writer.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Anyone have any questions?
You had gotten inspiration from the African Americans who had lived on, who'd worked for George Washington. How much did you draw from their actual story, and how much did you invent?
The question is, how much did I draw from actual records, and how much did I invent? It's mostly invention. I remember reading when Toni Morrison was writing Beloved, and she talked about researching, being inspired by the real life story of Margaret Garner, but then putting it aside because she wanted to leave room to invent, right? She didn't want to feel bound to the actual story. So I did read a lot about William Lee, but I read an important book by Henry Wingcheck called An Imperfect God, which is about the relationship between George Washington and the people that he enslaved. And I reread Frederick Douglass's three memoirs with some intensity, and some other, I read a book called Growing Up in Slavery by Yuval Taylor. I read a really important narrative by an enslaved man named Lewis Clark. It's kind of a thin book, but was really influential to me. And I guess one of the things about Yonder is there are some instances of brutality in the manuscript, in the novel. And I wanted, when people would say that seems a little too brutal or maybe that would never have happened, I wanted to be able to say, actually, I don't believe there is an atrocity in the book that wasn't inspired by a real life incident, right? So I did do that kind of research. But at some point I did put it aside and say, okay, enough of that. You know, I have to tell the story.
Thanks. Anyone else have a question?
I'm curious if you could talk about your, I guess it would be your process, like, because you're dealing with obviously very heavy life experiences and circumstances. How do you engage with that as a writer? You said you have to kind of put things aside and then come back to it, but how does that whole thing work for you?
Thank you for the question. The question is, how do I emotionally engage or deal with the emotional weight of dealing with material that can be heavy at times? And the short answer is yes, I do walk away from it, right? I do walk away from it and give myself some time to breathe and think about it. And also, I did remind myself periodically that, you know, despite those instances in the book, it is ultimately a love story. So I had to keep coming back to love, right? These are people, I mean, you know, maintaining a loving relationship is difficult under any circumstances. But imagine circumstances where the people who control you say, you're not even human. So why are we having this conversation? And William does have that conversation with the man who enslaves. He says, you know, you probably shouldn't be thinking about this romantic stuff. It's a little beyond you. And the man who enslaves him, Cannonball Green, actually compares William and Margaret's relationship to Cannonball Green's relationship with his horse, right, in all sincerity, and which is essentially what Thomas Jefferson did in Notes on the State of Virginia, right? So it's about taking that material and trying to render it in a way that makes it a compelling story. At the same time, you don't want the reader to, you know, take the book and throw it across the room because they're so upset. So when I presented something that I thought was particularly challenging, I said to myself, okay, now I got to come back with how they responded to this in an enlightening way.
Young lady over here, do you have a question?
Hey, Jabari, it's Lisa Elliott.
Hey, Lisa.
Here's my question. When do you know it's time to write? There are lots of thoughts that are going on. There's lots of emotion. When do you know it's time to connect that and put it to writing?
So the question is, how do I know when it's time to write? When to apply what's swirling in my head with what's on the with what needs to be on the paper? And I say this not facetiously, right? I'm actually serious, but I'm never not writing. I'm never not writing, right? So it's not, and I feel okay about that. Because I read Miles Davis's memoir many years ago, and the author of that memoir is at the festival, Quincy Troupe. And I remember Miles Davis talking about how he never had a period where he wasn't actually hearing music, right? So it's like, where do you get your ideas, Miles? And it's like, well, they're always there. It's just sometimes I have to get to a place and write them down and compose them. So that's, I've learned to kind of live with two narratives, right? So one is kind of always going all the time. And I mentioned the little notebook that I was carrying in Champaign, Illinois when I wrote down the first lines of this book. And I'm almost never without something like that. And if I'm without something like that, I will write on anything. I don't care at this point. I'm old enough now where I don't have to care about that kind of stuff, right? So I'll just scrawl it on whatever. And when I get to my computer, I will write it down. The other thing about that, Lisa, is that I always write out of sequence, right? So if I get an idea and I know it's not going to be until, you know, the 11th chapter of this, but I go ahead and write it anyway, right? And I know I'm going to get there. And the other thing that I do is I write my endings very early, as early in the process as possible. You know, Toni Morrison said, write the ending first, right? Write the salient points down, then write to the ending, which is essentially what I do. So, for example, in the novel before this, Only the Strong, the ending came to me really early. I knew there were going to be three people in a particular room under particular circumstances. So everything that came before that had to be me leading those three people to that room, right? And it really helped me streamline the narrative and tailor the plot so that it didn't wander in different directions. So I try to always be respectful of the appearance of ideas, you know, of characters, et cetera, and to also respond as quickly as possible, right? I mean, I'm not above or too ashamed to say, if you and I are having a conversation, can you hold that a minute? And I'll write something down. Because that's why I'm here. I'm at peace with why I am here and what purpose I'm meant to perform. And if we're friends and we understand each other, I know you will respect that. He's always just Jabari writing some stuff down, right? He'll come back to me in a minute and we'll continue our conversation.
Anyone else? Yes, sir.
As a writer, I struggle to find my own voice and to speak my own truth. And I was wondering if either of you guys could just give any input onto how you guys found your own voice in your writing.
Yeah, sure. Finding my own voice on writing. I guess I wanted to write about things I felt like that were important, but also you may not hear much about. Like, for instance, I recently picked up an award for writing about something that's going on in, you know, my early teenage years. Well, basically, like here in Chicago, particularly on the South Side, I wrote about these events I went to in my teenage years. They were always at like either churches or like community events, and kids would be DJing, breakdancing, or MCing or whatever. And these spaces, they were at these kids were in these spaces, and it was weird because it was kind of like in that. And we always talk about Chicago and violence and what happened out the street yesterday and all that. And yeah, these spaces where these kids were, you know, parents and everyone else knew where they were at and they allowed to be themselves. And many of these people are up here speaking or they're doing all these cool stuff around the city. And I wanted to tell that story of something that I was a part of, but also sometimes it's okay that sometimes we get in trouble where it's like some people do parachute journalism. They hop in a community and into a space and then they hop right back out and probably don't engage that space ever again unless they need a story. Well, I'm someone who's in that space and who still lives in that space. And sometimes it's best when people who are of a space run point on their stories. And those are the type of stories that seem to resonate with people. I know it's a long-winded answer to answer your question, but I mean, when you're of a space and you have these experiences or you're near someone who has these experiences, it's okay to, you know, to talk about them in that space and just kind of expose that to the world, because we get enough of what people think we are, right? And everybody knows the we I'm talking about in terms of, you know, proximity, race, and other areas. But so those stories are, it's a revolutionary act. It's a pushback of what other folks think that you and your communities consist of, and you're like, no, you're not here, you don't know us, or you can pretend to know us, but guess what, we know us better than you know us. So that's how you look at it.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I would add that you really need to be patient with yourself, right? And I think that was the key for me. Like, for example, I knew that people who study visual arts often go through a period where they are deliberately copying the masters, right? And so part of my apprenticeship as a writer was I was writing like people I was reading, right? And I knew that if I just continued to do that, eventually less of those people would appear and more of myself would. I mean, when I was in college, I was enamored with an African-American novelist named Chester Himes. And I had a period where everything I wrote just sounded like it just came right out of Chester Himes' typewriter. And I knew it, and it didn't bother me. I'm working through this material. I'm working through people who are influencing me. Eventually, I would come out the other side of it, and I'll sound like myself, right? And it took a moment. I expected it to take a moment, right? And so so I think the best thing about it was I was patient with myself.
Young lady in yonder, no pun intended, back there.
Product placement.
You mentioned having multiple narratives in Yonder, and one of the things that I'm curious about is how do you stay consistent when you have different plots, different narratives, different perspectives? How are you able to create that setting and straight line it so that it doesn't get confusing, doesn't make it seem like everything is being said as from the same person? How are you creating that? And when you see that you are making a mistake, for example, the narrative is not being coherent, what are some tips and tricks that you find to go step back and, you know, get the material back in line?
So So the question revolves around how to keep the characters distinct, how to keep the different narrations distinct. And so I do that a couple of ways. One is I create what I call a profile or a dossier on every character, right? So they each have their own file that I can return to at any time. And part of that is motivated, I cannot attribute the writer, but there's a creative writing instructor who has something on the internet called questions to ask your characters, right? So I always ask my characters, when were you born? What was your mother like? Do you remember? Did you know her? What are you afraid of? What's your favorite color? What's your favorite flavor? All of that, right? So I create these profiles on each character, and that kind of guides how they're going to speak, how their discourse is going to be. And also, like for example, in Yonder, two of the narrators have had contact with literacy. They've been read to, they've had an opportunity to look through books. So their vocabulary is distinct from the other narrators. So they use words that the other narrators would never use, for example. Another one of the characters adheres strictly to a spiritual practice, right? And so that spiritual practice infuses the way he talks. That's the character Cato. His best friend William wants nothing to do with those spiritual practices. So they don't resonate in his language. He's never gonna talk the way Cato talks, because the way he sees the world is so distinct from his. And I think early on I took a playwriting class in which the instructor was saying, you know, give each character things to say that only they would say, right? And we all have those in real life. I have expressions that I use every day that Evan does not. Evan has expressions he uses every day that I do not. So if someone was writing a story with both of us as characters, that would be one way in, right, of using that language. And that helps to keep the characters distinct. It also helps to read them out loud. It also helps to have someone else read them. So I occasionally had passages where my editor said, Cato sounds a little too much like William here. How can we change that? And I said, well, you know, Cato's thinking about his spirit. So I will put some spiritual language in there, and that will help make the distinction. And the other thing I will point out is two of the narrators are African-American women, and the editor of the book was an African-American woman, absolutely brilliant editor named Dawn Davis, who edited The Known World, which won the Pulitzer Prize for Edward P. Jones a few years back, just absolutely genius level editing, and she was very good at giving me constructive feedback in terms of how to make the voices genuine.
Anyone else have any questions?
Yes.
You're putting the mic out of work.
Going to the gym.
Foremost, thank you so much for this time and your responses and your insight. My question is for both of you in terms of, in the writing or editorial process, what has been most challenging and how have you been able to address that?
Good question. I guess with my book, if you aren't familiar with it, it's called Game Misconduct, Hockey's Toxic Culture and How to Fix It. And I talked about some of the things I noticed in hockey over time, and also my co-author and some of the things he noticed and everything else. And because our book is a lot. I mean, the challenge is when you want to talk about all these different things, but you have a limited amount of space to do so. You definitely, you know, make deals with yourself and think about it like, hey, like, I want to discuss. I guess I kind of looked at it as like, what are the top tier things that I want to discuss? But also, what can I, you know, do without? Or you know, like, you think of all these things, but you also still want, you know, the book to come across the things that you want to discuss. Yeah, so, I was just thinking about, yo, I want all these different topics to be involved. And when the reader comes away with reading a book, they feel like they're coming away with something. They're being, you know, educated. So I guess the main challenge is, do you, in your mind, like, are you satisfied with what you put out there? And I believe, we believe that we were.
Yeah, I think the challenge is different for each project, right? Depends on what I'm working on and what I'm confronting. But what I've tried to sort of be disciplined about through each of the books is to be more wary of digressions, right? Because if I'm having a long conversation with you, it's just the two of us, we talk for 3 hours, I'm going to digress a lot into all these different things that are interesting to me. And you're going to do the same thing. And we're going to keep coming back. And we're going to give ourselves, we're going to relax the rules of discourse enough to be patient with each other. A reader will do no such thing. So the minute you start doing that, you're inviting the reader to think about something other than your book, right? Do I need to put gas in the car? Do I leave the oven on? What, you know, what's going on with the laundry? You know, all these other thoughts begin to intrude. And so my challenge is to keep the reader focused on the book. And one way that has manifested in the work is that the work has gotten slimmer because I've become increasingly conscious of wearing out my welcome with the reader because all these other things are competing for her attention. So I sort of want to get in, get her hooked, and then leave her wanting more, as opposed to saying, man, when is this book going to end, right? Is there, you know, let me skip to the, oh, there's another 50 pages, right? you don't want that. So that has been the thing that I've worked on, I think, the most as I've progressed through the books.
Thanks. Anyone else have a question? Oh, we have like 5 minutes. I got the hard out 5 minutes.
You have a question?
Hello.
Hi.
This question is for Jabari. Have you considered at all going into screenwriting or taking your stories and information, going to either television or film to get those stories out?
So the question is, have I considered writing in forms like screenplays and teleplays, I think, if I understand correctly? Not in recent years. When I first started out, I wrote in every genre. And I remember telling my wife, I'm going to write in every genre, and whatever sticks, that's what I'm going to do, right? And at that time, it was journalism. I got some amazing opportunities in journalism, so I worked in journalism for many years. The previous speaker in this room, I don't know if any of you all were here, one of them was Maria Rana, who was editor of Washington Post Book World for many years. Well, I was deputy editor of Washington Post Book World for those same years. So we actually, it was kind of nice to cross paths with her here. So I focused on journalism during most of that period. But before I jumped into journalism, I did go out to California in my early 20s. I had many sample scripts under my arm, had some meetings, got some people to read them, and they went nowhere. And I was practical, so I said, well, what else is on my list? There's journalism, there's fiction, there's poetry. Let me try these other things. And I had some successes in those other things, so I stayed with them. But the long and short of that is now I'm being approached by filmmakers to discuss adaptations of work that I actually wrote as fiction. So it's kind of come full circle. But I'm at a different space too. So it's not something I'm necessarily eager to do. I'm not opposed to it either, you know. But I have a lot of book projects lined up, and several of them are under contract, so they will take priority.
Thank you for listening to
us.
Ramble on.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, contributing authors Luis Alberto Uria, Juan Martinez, Joe Mino, and Jack Gems discuss their work in the collection Small Odysseys. Selected shorts present 35 new short stories. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.